Hey, thanks for having me. I'm going to be talking about FAI and hip arthroscopy. This is a topic area that's specifically an interest of mine with Dr. Alfred Mansour, who's basically founded a hip preservation program. He and I have worked really closely together to develop what you're going to see in this presentation. Some of it is post-operative, and some of it is identifying diagnostic and etiology of FAI, specifically because FAI has become so popular and kind of the new sexy thing in hip land. If you have any hip pain, it must be FAI, and we all need surgery. So hopefully we can identify a few things specifically about that and clarify some of that. So the first thing is going to be defining what FAI is and why it's a spectrum more than a condition. We'll talk about how the management profile looks for these individuals. We'll look at briefly the surgical approach with hip arthroscopy, what that looks like and how the OR is set up. And then finally, the pros and pitfalls of post-op management. This will bleed over a little bit into my lab section in the next hour or so. We'll discuss specifically what these patients look like coming in, how we treat them post-operative day one, and what that looks like. And again, I have no disclosures for this presentation. Okay, so FAI. What is that specifically? FAI stands for femoral acetabular impingement. It is the encroachment or the abutment of the femur and the acetabulum, right? That's specifically what it means. However, it has come to mean something dramatically different in societal definition because it's become equated to these two terms, CAM and pincer. CAM is defining the abnormal morphology of the femur. All right, so the femoral head should be more spherical shaped. A CAM type morphology is a more ovular type shape. Okay, the pincer side is on the acetabulum. It is the overgrowth of the cartilage of the acetabulum, not necessarily a deepening of the socket. It's more of a protrusion of the acetabular rim. Okay? Labral tears, we know this from shoulder anatomy, right? It's the tearing of the cartilage rim that protrudes over the edge of the acetabulum. This area can be torn, abrased, or frayed. And then finally, dysplasia. And I want to clarify something specifically about dysplasia. So dysplasia means any abnormal bone growth, or really abnormal growth, cellular growth. So technically, your CAM and your pincer are dysplastic terms inside your hip. However, when you're talking specifically about the hip and somebody says the term dysplasia, they're typically talking about a lack of covering of the acetabulum, or a shallowing or a turning of the acetabulum itself, not on the femur, and not the cartilage overgrowth. It's a shallowing. Very similar to what you would see in developmental dysplasia of a child, where they lack the necessary depth of the acetabulum at birth, and they have to put in, or they're typically put in splints to deepen that to provide coverage of the femur. And then finally, cartilage delaminization, which is essentially an abrasion and an abutment of the cartilage that causes it to bubble and shear away from the subchondral bone. Okay, so quick definition overview. This will make more sense when we talk about things here in a second. So hip pain. This is a little bit of a schema to define where we are with FAI. Okay, so if we look at the top, we're obviously talking about hip pain, not SI joint pain, not low back pain. We're eliminating those variables from the equation. Extra-articular pain, these are the things like your hernias, your snapping hip syndromes. These are outside of the capsule itself. Tendinopathies, hip flexor tendinopathies, etc., right? What we're talking about specifically, intra-articular pain, so FAI is intra-articular, it is non-arthritic. I want to specifically point this out as well because an arthritic condition of the hip is not a candidate for FAI-type surgery, for hip arthroscopy. They don't do well, they typically fail, and they don't resolve the condition because, as most of you know, the only way you can fix severe OA or arthritis is with a joint replacement or some type of cartilage transplant or covering. So again, FAI is non-arthritic, intra-articular, and it can be defined specifically by the pathologies that it produces, i.e. your cartilage defects or your labral tears. So FAI is not painful. You can have FAI and not have pain. FAI is defining the etiology of pain that's intra-articular and non-arthritic. I hope that clarifies the condition a little bit. And then finally, what are the causes of your labral tears and cartilage defects? It could be instability, and it could be FAI. And so we're kind of funneling our way all the way down to the bottom right where it says FAI, which can cause labral tears and cartilage defects. And FAI is dysplasia, an abnormal shape of the bones of the hip itself, and movement-based. And we'll discuss that here in a second with some cases. All right, so clarifying the issue. So again, FAI is a spectrum and a syndrome. If you take anything away from this morning, I want to make sure that you understand that FAI is not, it's a diagnosis, but it's the same thing as saying somebody has shoulder impingement. That is not defining the pathology. It's simply defining the mechanism by which things are happening. All right, so it has come to describe itself in societal. If somebody walked up to me and said, Chris, I have FAI. What they're probably meaning is I have a morphologic abnormality, a cam or a pincer, or mixed, as in they have both cam and pincer deformities of their hip, and they're causing some damage to some structure in the hip, i.e. the labrum or the cartilage. Okay? So what this eventually produces is that tearing of the cartilage and deconstruction of the hip itself. Losing those congruencies will eventually, based on most literature at this point, can lead to early onset of OA. So that's the rationale behind addressing these conditions early on. And ultimately, I want you to think about FAI as this shoulder impingement. How would you correct shoulder impingement? Does every patient with shoulder impingement come in and say, yep, I have shoulder impingement. I don't know why I'm in PT. I need surgery. You gotta reform my shoulder. It's just not gonna work. That's not always the case. And that's exactly what FAI means, in the hip as well. And then finally, what are the factors that lead to determining whether or not somebody with FAI syndrome needs surgery or needs corrective mechanisms at all? And ultimately, it comes down to this. Strength, control, microinstability factors, weakness or neuromuscular control, active or movement factors. We'll discuss all these here in a second with some nice easy cases to drive this stuff home. And dysplasia or bony factors. Again, your cam or pincer are probably the most popular bony factors. Okay, so FAI, points to consider. These are the questions that I get asked the most when I lecture or if I'm seeing a patient with this FAI type syndrome. So I have FAI. What exactly does that mean? And I'll typically describe that as we just did. FAI is specifically a syndrome that is based on intra-articular hip pain. So you have pain that's inside your hip joint that's caused by some combination of factors leading to abnormal encroachment or abutment of the two structures of your hip, i.e. the ball and the socket. For whatever reason, something that you're doing is causing some compression and contact of these two structures, which is leading to your pain. All right. So is FAI a pathology? And I'll typically say no. FAI is a risk. It's a risk factor, right? It's the kindling that just needs a spark. Okay. So I've had this for years, right? So did I just all of a sudden develop this abnormal shape of my femur or of my hip in general? Well, no. We know from good literature that these are developmental conditions, as in children under the age of adolescence or maturation typically don't have these morphologic characteristics of FAI. So this is developmental. They're acquiring this via sport, via movement, via activity, and eventually just leading with this risk factor throughout life. And what it takes is just the catalyst. It takes a spark to generate pain or develop a labral tear or cartilage damage, which allows them to be grouped and identified as having FAI. Okay? So does every FAI need, or every FAI have a labral tear? Absolutely not. Over half of us in this room probably have what would be considered radiographic FAI. You have an abnormality in the shape of your femur. You may have some overgrowth. You may have some turning of the acetabulum. All of that would be considered FAI, and I don't think over half of us have had hip labral surgery or FAI type surgery in this room. Does every labral tear have an FAI etiology? Absolutely not. You can tear your labrum. It's very similar to a shoulder. You can have this kind of degenerative labral tear, right, over time in a thrower and an overhead athlete, in a manual worker. You could also have a traumatic labral tear. These happen just as commonly as the other. I would say that people are more likely to seek out immediate medical condition for an immediate traumatic labral tear, as in they slip or fell. I had a patient that fell off of a truck bed, landed in kind of a lunge position, and ruptured their labrum at that time point. So you don't have to have FAI to have a labral tear. Does FAI have to include a cam or a pincer? No, absolutely not. You can have movement-type FAI where, again, thinking about the shoulder, because most of us can equate better to the shoulder, but if you take your arm into horizontal adduction and flexion, that's an impingement position, right? We've probably seen that, or there's a special test with near impingement that pulls your arm across. Again, if you pull your arm far enough into adduction and internal rotation and a little bit of flexion, you're going to abut the structures of your shoulder whether you have FAI or not. So you don't have to have these morphologic characteristics to still have FAI or to have impingement. However, it's more likely that you do if you're having that amount of symptom. All right? And so, do all labral tears equal hip pain? Absolutely not. Same thing we talked about earlier with FAI, you could have the morphology. You could also have a labral tear and never have any hip pain. You may just not be moving to the end ranges of motion commonly enough to cause hip pain. If you don't flex your leg in adduction internal rotation of your hip, you may not have any pain of that of that labrum in general. Does every FAI need surgery? And that's also an absolute no. Same thing with the shoulder impingement. Just because you have FAI does not mean that the only way to fix it is with surgery. Do all labral tears need surgery? Absolutely not. There are plenty of other mechanisms. The same thing in the shoulder. We see plenty of patients that have some type of labral pathology of their shoulder. If you can find ways to basically offload the labrum, allow that true inflammatory condition to calm down, and it typically goes away. And then, why or when do we consider surgery? And this will go further into kind of our next little case presentation, and hopefully it's large enough that you can read some of it. I'll walk through these, but these are cases that I want to walk through that will better identify these conditions that we just spoke about. So the first one says control or strength impingement. This is that micro instability. Okay, so what I want you to look at is the schema here, that is, or this little Venn diagram that's off to the side, right? And it's got three variables that are overlapping. Okay, the one at the top says morphology, cam, pincer, or instability. Okay, so these are bony shapes. That's a risk factor. To the bottom left, you have strength and control, which is micro instability, as in somebody that is weak. That's also a risk factor for developing labral tears or FAI type conditions. The bottom right says movement or activity. That's your third risk factor. Okay. So at any point, if you overlap any of those circles, you can end up into a painful condition of FAI. Right. So the first one, control, strength, or impingement. So this actually works out well. Ryan just spoke a little bit about our athletes that are squatting. So if you take an athlete that has a really bad, really crappy squat, maybe they kick their butt out and they dump forward, or if anybody's familiar with the butt wink, it's the anterior pelvic tilt or that lordosis that exists at somebody in the bottom of a squat. If you think about what that mechanism will do, if you anteriorly pelvic tilt, it is going to bring your acetabulum forward, aka it's going to limit the amount of flexion you have the other way. Right? If I posterior pelvic tilt, I can lift my hip much higher. If I anterior pelvic tilt, obviously I'm going to bring the abutment of the two structures quicker. So if you have pinching, groin pain at the bottom of a squat, you may just have a strength deficit. You cannot stabilize your pelvis enough to squat, so you may have FAI because you can't squat well. Right? You may have had this shape, these bony shapes that you've had your entire life, but now you're squatting more readily, maybe in college or with a sports team, that you're developing pain, and now somebody says, well, you must have FAI because you have pinching in your groin. Or maybe your squat's just crappy. That's probably more the case. All right. Now, what if the athlete also had a big cam development of their femur? That may make that condition worse. And so this is where the spectrum falls into play, right? So we need to identify both. In conservative management, obviously, we're gonna address the movement pathology, the squatting mechanics, and the strength before we're even going to address these other conditions that have existed for 20 years and now all of a sudden have become the spotlight. Okay, so number two is the volume phenomena, right? And this is your movement or activity in the bottom right. This is your ballet dancer that is moving to extreme ranges of motion. Okay, so as we talked about earlier, if you take your shoulder far enough into adduction and flexion, you're going to develop impingement. It's going to stop at some point. You only have so much space. A ballet dancer or some type of extreme dancing type modality is going to put these patients at the very end ranges of their available motion. So they may not have morphology, aka the cam or the pincer, but they're moving so far into these extremes that they're impinging anyway. Right? And so that's more of your movement impingement. All right? So again, you would treat that with maybe movement limitation initially and working on strength deficits that usually exist with these patients otherwise. Okay, and then the third one down, the morphology or dysplasia. Okay, so this is the person that says, unfortunately, Chris, I am the best hockey goalie in town. I love playing goalie. That's all I want to do. However, this is a 18-year-old kid that's had hip pain for a while, and you're trying to figure out why, and it turns out he's got this huge cam morphology on his femur, right? And if you look at this picture, that is the absolute worst position you could be in if you have intra-articular FAI or hip pain, right? It's flexion, interrotation, and adduction. So this bony shape has completely self-limited him from playing hockey. And there's really not a whole lot we can do because of the shape of the femur, right? So regardless of how strong he can be, you can't stretch him into that position because you're going to run into basically the femur at this point. And so you really run out of options here. Right, what do you do? How do you change this? Well, you want to play defense? No, I want to play goalie. I don't have much answer for that. Because of the bony shape, you're just going to continue to manage and just mangle your hip labrum and cause pain. Okay, and then last thing is the radiographic asymptomatic FAI. So if we took everybody in this room, and let's say part of our physicals, we wanted to take some hip x-rays for whatever reason, and we found out that over half of us had FAI morphology, how many of us would need surgery? Probably none. And again, for these reasons. So just because you have the shape doesn't mean you have to have the pain. And if you look at this, again, the Venn diagram up here at the top, let's say that I have a really, really big cam morphology. Okay, so I have a really abnormal shape to my femur. However, I don't run. I don't really do a whole lot of extraneous exercise. I don't do a whole lot of squatting past 90 degrees. I probably never knew I have it, and I'm probably fine. However, let's say I have a small cam, and I decide to play goalie for my local hockey team. That's probably going to show itself more than the person with the big cam, if that makes sense to you, right? Or I could have a small cam lesion and play baseball, and then the strength coach comes in and says, you know what, we're going to start squatting lower because there's good research that squatting past 90 degrees is an increase in muscle recruitment and overall performance variables. And so now we're going to start squatting deeper, and I have a smaller cam, but it gets exposed because the movement combination of movement and morphology puts me in this painful range, right? Or lastly, God forbid you have all three, right? You got crappy hip mechanics, you're super weak, and you have some morphology problems. So you can imagine how these patients come in when we're looking at these patients from an evaluative standpoint. We're having to tease out if you're weak, if your movement's bad, all these issues. Okay, so again, a bit of a take-home slide, and the focus of the presentation is to get into more of the post-operative rehab, but it's impossible to talk about this stuff unless you understand what the pathology is, etiologically speaking. And so remember, FAI is a syndrome that causes tissue damage. Tissue damage is the reason that these patients are painful, not because they have FAI. All right, dysplasia. If you hear somebody say the word dysplasia, they're typically talking about shallowing or instability of their hip, although dysplasia in technical definitions could mean any of these relative shapes. FAI is a spectrum, and labral tears are the painful result. Right? Not all FAI can lead to labral tears, and it's a good example of this wood here, this kindling. Right? You may have all of these factors against you, but if you don't light the fire, it's never going to burn. All right? FAI is a combination of factors that equal risk. So labral tears without FAI, FAI and no hip pain or labral tears. Management typically involves a variety of factors, and it's not always surgical. And so this gets into our management kind of algorithm. And again, I want to point out Alfred Mansour. He and I have worked really, really closely over the last couple years to develop a lot of what is the UT Memorial Hermann Comprehensive Hip Preservation Program. And you're going to say, well, Chris, what is the hip preservation program? What are we preserving? We're preserving FAI. We're preserving FAI from generating OA. Okay, so our primary goal as this program is to prevent, it's ultimately mitigate the process of OA via surgical intervention, via conservative management. Okay, and so what this looks like, and I apologize again, it's a little small, but this is probably one of the best analogies that I use with my patients, and I stole this from Alfred, so I told him I'd give him credit for it just in case, but so it's the canary in the mine shaft. And if anybody's familiar with this analogy, there were coal miners, right? This was back when coal was much more popular than it is now. But these miners would be down in the mine shaft. They would bring a canary in a cage, okay? And when the sulfur levels or the toxicity levels, the CO2, would get high enough, it would kill the canary in the cage. And the workers knew it was time to get out of the mine shaft, Right? So that was their alarming mechanism by which they found out if the chamber was toxic. And so what he talks about is, what do these things look like in our patients? So scenario one is the traumatic labral tear. Okay, so if you follow me for a second, this is the patient that slips off the truck bed, lands, tears their labrum. And so if you think about it, we're just simply going to replace the canary, right? You drop the cage broke, and it killed the canary, right? The mine shaft is still okay. You just got unlucky. Okay? Scenario two, progressive repetitive injury with a labral tear or FAI. So there's two sides to this, right? So this means that the canary is dead, and you're not real sure why it's died, but there's some variables in there that you feel like maybe it's the CO2, maybe it's the sulfur, maybe we're too far down in the shaft, maybe there's not enough oxygen. There's a lot of different variables here. And so there's two routes to that. There's a conservative route and the surgical route. The conservative management side typically includes some type of injection, hip strengthening. This is basically your conservative shoulder management procedure, right? You would go through injections, medications, move them out of that impingement position, try to deload the labrum, try to strengthen up the hip to prevent encroachment or impingement. And then there's surgical management. And this gets into, if you can read this, I apologize, but it says repair or replace the canary. That seems obvious. But if there's sulfur in the mine and I just keep replacing the canary, then the canary is going to keep dying. So it doesn't do you any good to just simply go in there and repair the labrum, because the labrum is going to keep rupturing or getting torn or be torn because of the mechanics. And so what you end up having to do is remedy the mine shaft. And this happens with surgical consultation, where they're going to reshape the femoral head or take down some of that pincer overgrowth or both. Okay? And then scenario three is your progressive repetitive injury with labral tear and OA. Right? So if you have OA, hip arthroscopy is not a good idea for you, because we know from research that they don't do well. You're not at all remedying the problem. The cartilage defects are the overarching painful driver, right? That is your provocation aspect. If you just replace the canary or the labrum, then it's not going to change anything. They're still going to have hip pain. They still have denaturing and subchondral edema showing from the underlying bone. Okay, and then the last thing is scenario four, which is your basically progressive repetitive injury, FAI, and dysplasia. And dysplasia specifically meaning shallowing of the acetabulum or shaping disparity. And this involves a completely different surgery, still managing that condition. Okay, so really where we are for the rest of the presentation is here. So this is a surgical management, i.e. we're replacing the canary, but we're also changing and kind of remedying the mechanics of the mine shaft to prevent this progressive repetitive injury to the labrum, i.e. FAI. Okay? Cool. All right. So fixing the canary. This is typically what your hip arthroscopy is going to look like. Picture on the left is looking at a surgical OR presentation. They're tractioned out under fluoro, and the three instruments are inserted, usually irrigation, some type of surgical kind of construction device, if you will, and then finally some kind of light source. Okay, and that's the picture on the right. So you can see the three different poles that typically exist in your patient's postoperative management. All right. So what is coming in to see us? And this is, again, probably where you're going to take the most information away about management. And we'll cover this a little bit more in depth when we get into the lab section. But PT typically, they start 1 to 2 days after their surgery, which seems a little crazy. The reason and the rationale behind this is when they first started doing a lot of hip arthroscopy, there was a high risk of adhesion formation, i.e. the capsule was adhering to the posterior aspect of the hip flexor, right, of the psoas. And so what you ended up with is this really stiff interface where there should be a bursa there. The bursa hardens, the capsule hardens, and it all meshes into the hip flexor. So when you basically just friction itself to death, and you end up with hip flexor pain that lasts much longer than the actual surgical pain. So they're coming in usually day one, 1 to 5 typically anyway, and they are 20 pounds weight bearing. This is modified weight bearing. We don't want full weight bearing to put any shear force, because most labral tears are anterior superior, and weight bearing would put more pressure on those structures. They're also using a specific type of gait progression, and we use the 2-2-2 route. 2 weeks of step two gait. So if you imagine my right leg is the painful leg, when I put my crutch and my foot down, I'm only stepping two with my left leg, right? So it looks something similar to this. As opposed to 2 weeks after that, we're using the step through gait where it would just be normal ambulation with a modified weight bearing, 20-pound weight bearing. And then the last 2 weeks, i.e. your 4 to 6 weeks, you're progressing the weight-bearing status of the lower extremity limb with the crutches. They're using a CPM machine for early motion. Sometimes they're in a hip brace. It depends on the procedure that was done. They wear derotation boots, which are these absolutely dreadful pieces of equipment that every patient loves to complain about. What this does is they're lying fully supine with their feet strapped in. I don't have a picture. It prevents extra rotation while they're asleep. The rationale behind this is if you imagine here, they're typically penetrating the anterior aspect of the capsule and they are suturing the anterior aspect of the capsule closed. The rationale is that over time we found out that not closing the anterior aspect of the capsule after these surgeries led to instability of the hip. And these patients had ongoing, really, really, really diffuse, really nonspecific symptoms. And so now most surgeons are closing the capsule. The problem is, if you're closing the anterior aspect of the capsule, thinking arthrokinematically, if you externally rotate and extend your hip, you're going to put force on the anterior aspect of the capsule and could potentially rupture the closure site. And you don't want that. So they're in these fancy boots for a few days. Typical range of motion restrictions, 90 degrees for 2 weeks. Flexion, abduction 45 degrees, external rotation 0 to 20, extension 0 degrees for 3 weeks. And then intra rotation abduction are typically non-limited, more by pain. Okay, so our pearls for postoperative rehab. And we'll cover these kind of one by one quickly, make sure I'm okay on time here. I think so. So we're going to walk through some of these, and again, superficially, because a lot of this will be covered in lab. Adhesion, so early range of motion, hip extension, weight bearing, soft tissue management, and then when to pull back. So early range of motion. So these are a couple of ideas that we use quite specifically. Some of these caregiver range of motion, passive range of motion, circumduction, CPM, all those things are going to do well to keep the hip moving. We'll let the patient get on the bike as early as day one or two. Now, this comes with a little bit of a caveat that there should be no pinching, and most of them will experience some type of mild pinching of the hip for the first week or so. So we just limit the amount of time. So they're typically doing less than 20 minutes early on, but the bike actually feels nice for most of these patients. Joint MOBs, nothing in range, so kind of mid-range type 2 type MOBs typically feel pretty good. Desensitize the hip, turn off some alarms. And then ice, right? Treat it like it's hurt. It's fairly obvious, but it can dramatically help how their hip feels. Hip extension. So this is a little bit a case for argument. Now, Dr. Mansour and I have moved into this direction because we feel like it's more beneficial for the patients to be in neutral early on to prevent any kind of capsule irritation or contracture. However, we don't want to push them into extension. So it's a fine line. So notice that I have up here that no hyperextension, and that's really important. I don't want hyperextension, I want neutral. And so what we'll have them do is we'll start tummy time day one or day two with a pillow underneath their hips. So there's still a little bit of hip flexion, but they're still lying prone. Prone lying is the easiest way to get some patients out of this hip contracture position, right? It's a graduated load. They typically like it because they didn't expect to be lying on their hip, on their stomach this soon. Patients actually really enjoy that. Opposite knee to chest. And you're like, wow, there's no way you can stretch. If you try this later on today, we'll do it in the lab, but you bring your opposite knee. It doesn't matter. Obviously, you don't have an involved leg, but bring one leg to your chest and try to straighten your down leg. It's a huge stretch on the front of your hip flexor, way more than you think it would be, especially for these patients. And then gait. So how do we cue gait to limit extension, but also to modify our weight bearing? And it's really important that we use this foot flat cadence. We don't want patients crutching around with their involved hip in a state of contracture, hip flexion contracture. This is the kiss of death that they're walking around like this. They will end up with just searing hip flexor pain. So what we tell them is it's foot flat, modified weight bearing. So your crutches are offloading you, but you're still putting your foot flat, right, when you're crutching. Okay? And then muscle activation. So very similar to what the quad would be in our in most of our knee patients. If you don't have terminal knee extension, your quad is never going to work as well as it would. So we want neutral so we can get the glutes firing. The glutes are the quads of the hip. Okay, so we need to get those glutes fired up. It's really hard to do when you put somebody in hip flexion. So we want them neutral so we can get that activated, pump some of the effusion out of that. So recruitment, core pelvic control, all of that stuff falls into this phase of reactivating the muscles of the hip in an isometric type environment, not movement environments. Okay? The weight-bearing dialogue, and we discussed this a little bit already. So the order says 20 pounds. I have no idea what that means to me. So you can get a scale, sure, and put their foot on there and say, look, that's 20 pounds. It looks great. Or what we typically do is it's just the weight of your leg. If you put your foot flat on the floor, that's around 20 pounds. Okay? And then why do we do that? Because I can move a heck of a lot faster, Chris. If I just hold my leg up, I can roll. I know, but if you do that, you will end up with hip flexor pain. All right, and so the risk for that is so much higher if they don't put their foot flat. However, you're going to have to work with them on how much that 20 pounds feels like, because they can easily get out of 20 pounds because it's going to feel pretty good early on. And then lots of ice, et cetera. I would really, really, really caution anybody. I mean, and this goes the case with your total hips as well, but no resisted straight leg raise into flexion for the first 6 to 8 weeks. And I would say even up to 12 to 14 weeks. I don't have any patient post-operative hip scope do any straight leg raise in flexion for the first 14 weeks almost, okay, for that exact reason. Soft tissue and nerve mobility. This is something that we have absolutely moved towards in the last probably year to prevent, and I'm speaking specifically to the nerve glides at the bottom, to prevent adhesion of the neural complexes of the hip. Right, and this is the femoral nerve, this is your sciatic. Moving these nerves around, you'll be amazed how much you will prevent later on. Okay, now again, these patients can't stretch. Oh God, Chris, if I could just stretch a little bit, I could stretch my hamstrings, I'd feel so great. I know you can't bend forward. You just can't do that right now because of the hip. So what we encourage is every patient will go by this little tiger tail or some type of and soft tissue modality device. They can do it at home. All right, roll out their adductors, their hip flexors, etc. It'll go such a long way that your patients will love you for it. And when to pull back. This, again, is probably where therapists make the biggest mistake in that, well, the motion's not coming around. I'm a little worried. They're going back to see doc. Should I be concerned because they're not where they're supposed to be? Maybe if we just, well, let's just kind of push a little bit. It couldn't be further from the truth. These hips are so temperamental. If you try to push them, and they're in any case synovitic, which is this real nasty looking picture here, the synovium and the capsule are irritated. If you try to push them, you will do nothing but make them worse. I can absolutely guarantee it. So in these cases, right, and these are some of the things that you look for, changes in range of motion. They may start losing range of motion, and you're like, oh my God, what's going on? I'm a little worried. All right, mid-range multi-directional pain, that can't be right, right? We're not encroaching the labrum. We're not doing anything there. There should be no reason for that. Log roll, which is basically supine internal-external rotation at 0 degrees on the table. If you're painful in that position, the hip joint is effused and irritated. And so at that point, you just make a smart decision and you say, you know what? We're pulling back. I want you back on your crutches if you're off of them. You're going to ice. You're going to get in prone a couple times a day. You're going to do some isometrics. Go back to day one, you'll be amazed how fast this will resolve if you get ahead of it. If you try to keep pushing them, they will continue to push back and it'll make it worse. Okay, so I apologize, this came out much smaller than I intended it to, but to read from the top, how do I use my crutches? So these are the questions. This is the Q&A that I get 98% of the time the patients come in. How do I use my crutches and why can't I let my leg go behind me? So you should be able to answer that now, right? Capsule protection and restriction of weight-bearing status for the labral repair. Feels good to have it bent a little. Yeah, I know it feels nice, but we want to prevent that contracture, very similar to what an ACL would be in the knee. We don't want to leave them in mild knee flexion because it'll shorten that way. Can I put my foot down? What about all of my weight? No, we got to protect your labrum a little bit. So I can't find my butt or my quad muscle. Did they hit a nerve? No, that's part of the process. The surgery typically causes what's called iatrogenic inhibition. The joint's swollen, irritated, it shuts the muscles down around it. These boots are the worst thing I've ever had, and I knew I had a picture in here somewhere. These are the infamous derotation boots. They're the worst thing in the world, Chris. I can't use them. I know. Just give me at least a week's worth, and then we can talk about taking you out of them as you feel comfortable. But the first week, you got to wear them. Thigh and groin numbness. So that there's a perineal post, if you remember from the surgical view. There's a post here so that they can traction the leg out. So you may have some saddle numbness that should resolve. Keep an eye on that. Anterior portal is pretty close to the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve, so they may have some lateral numbness, which would be more here. And then finally, the posterior portal may have some sciatic involvement. They've moved away being so posterior, but you may have some of those things. That all of this should resolve. And am I really supposed to get on the bike today? Absolutely. Absolutely. If you can, biking early on is absolutely indicated. And then these are your longer term questions, right? Day 10, day 14. I'm feeling much better, Chris. So let's go. Like I'm going to be your rock star. I'm the poster child. Yeah, I know. I apologize, but that's not how this is going to go. We're going to keep going slow because I promised if you push it, it'll push back. Work and school. We try to limit patients to sitting for prolonged periods of time just because of that hip flexion moment will put a lot of stress on the joint, especially when it's swollen. When can I drive? Well, you can't be on pain meds when you drive, and you really need to be conscious about that. And then exercise. Upper body exercise is fine. Limit how much lower body work. You're not going to do any of that until we clear it ultimately. Okay? And then in summary, so this wraps everything up, and this goes for what we've been speaking about the whole time. The biggest things for us, and again, from my presentation, what I'd like to take away is understanding what FAI is and what it's not. Ultimately, understanding what the management algorithm is. And if they do end up into surgery, understand that this goes much slower than we think it should because patients are doing well. Please, please, please take it easy early on. Your patients will appreciate it, even though they don't know any better. They will do much better the slower that you progress them and the more isometric exercise and facilitated recruitment you can put them through. Cool. Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. And like I said, I'll have a lab section here in a little bit. We'll discuss this a little bit more. Thanks so much.